Hello and welcome everybody to A Leader's Impact, the IRIS Interviews podcast. I'm Lizzie Barry, HR Director here at IRIS Software Group, and today I'm delighted to be joined by our guest speaker, Jessica Swan, Chief Operating Officer for Talentful. Jessica, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, please?
Yeah, of course. But thank you so much for having me, by the way. I know we've been talking about being on this podcast together for a really long time, so excited that we get to do it today. My name is Jessica Swan, as you said. I have been COO at Talentful for a couple of months, and prior to that, I was the COO of a company called Whereby. But I have a long history working in people and legal as well, but mostly really focused on like kind of people operations type work that then grew into COO. So I'm excited to chat to you a little bit about that version of my experience as it applies to our topic.
Fabulous. And congratulations on your new role. Very exciting. So we're talking today about workplaces and workplace culture. And we know that for a long time, workplaces have been a place of mixed culture, different ages and opinions. But actually, as we've seen, certainly over the past few years, particularly as older generations either return to work or continue to work for longer, and particularly with Gen Z entering the workforce with an appetite for change and sometimes different values, employers have sometimes struggled to maintain harmony. So the workplace demographic shifts are said to be more polarized than ever before. And often we found that taking a blanket approach based on generational stereotypes just doesn't always work. So in today's episode, we'll be exploring how leaders like yourself can make an informed decision based on truths rather than generalizations to ultimately ensure a more effective approach to people management and to foster an environment where every voice matters. So I will start today with really kind of digging into some of your experience and expertise. So from what you've seen, how have workplace dynamics evolved in recent years, and particularly with, as people have said, the four generations now in the workplace, so baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, and now Gen Z. And have you noticed any rise in culture clashes that's been associated with that?
Four generations, wow, that seems so crazy. I mean, maybe that's always been the case, I'm not sure. But yeah, I think the big change or the big shift has been the difference between the upbringing, I think, of a baby boomer versus somebody who has grown up on TikTok, essentially. Or, you know, maybe that's a little bit silly to say, but people that have grown up with a much more social media heavy childhood, much more technology heavy childhood, those are really big differences as it applies to work. The big shifts here is that we have people that their working lives are impacted massively by technology, and they have been introduced to technology at radically different times of their lives. Whereas, you know, I'm thinking about even the difference between my entrance to the workforce and my mother, right? Or, you know, she's one of the baby boomer generation. Really, the big difference was emails, but that is, I think, relatively simple to understand comparative to like the introduction of AI and artificial intelligence. Social media platforms now being used more in workplaces, the more public sharing of information online and on the internet, and then obviously the kind of elephant in the room with almost every discussion now is remote working. I don't really see it as having that many culture clashes between employees necessarily, but I definitely think it makes for a more challenging environment between kind of business communications and employees rather than employee to employee, if that makes sense. Purely because I think sometimes it's difficult for an employer to kind of address that huge gap of knowledge and background in a way that feels like it works for everybody within that new group of employees that you have.
Absolutely. Now, I was thinking as you were talking of my partner's in recruitment, and he has colleagues who are old enough to remember when fax machines were the ways to send resumes out to candidates and clients. And that just seems absolutely wild that that was the way that you got information from A to B. And I remember them saying, actually, it was wildly inefficient because you could only get one fax at a time. And so recruitment agencies would try and kind of jam their clients' fax machines by saying, well, if we've sent these over, no competitors can. So it's astonishing the different ways that it impacts people.
I had a person in my team, I think probably like a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, and we got an email from a bank in the US, which is, you know, banks in the US are a little bit more old school than I think we're used to maybe in the UK. But we got an email from a bank in the US asking us to fax over proof of employment for somebody who was applying for a mortgage. And this member of my team, bless them, messaged me and said, do we have this fax account? Like, do we need to set something up? Like, is it a service? And I realized, like, oh, you just did not know what a fax was.
Yeah, I can totally believe it. There are amazing videos that I've seen online about getting Gen Z versus even millennials to do like a phone sign with their fingers, where they're like, what would you do to look like you're on the phone? And all the millennials hold their two fingers up in that way. And then all of the Gen Z just put their full palm up and talk to a full palm. So,
oh my goodness, that's so wild. Okay, I feel very old.
So how do you find, I know you'd mentioned that there can be some differences in how people like to communicate or how we're used to communicating with the different generations. So can you give us an example about how you've seen that in practice?
Yeah, I think especially the last couple of years has been a real drive towards asynchronous communication, which I think is largely a good thing, right? Like remote working has been, I think, extremely positive for a lot of people around the world. And remote working naturally leads itself towards asynchronous communication because people are more geographically distributed, they're more distributed in terms of time zones, et cetera. So you're doing a lot more written communication. I know a lot of people, and I've worked with a lot of people that grew up in a working environment where it was extremely synchronous. You came up with ideas in person, decisions were made much more on the fly. You did not need to document your decision-making processes thoroughly. So there is a kind of gap between expectation and reality, I think, between our younger generation of workers who kind of instinctively understand the idea of asynchronous communication, because a lot of their communication, even with their friend group and socially, is asynchronous, right? You post a story, you post something on Instagram, or you post a blog if it's professional. And, you know, there's not so many group webinar type ways to share your discussions. Whereas I think the older generation is much less inclined to do that naturally. So there is this kind of like forcing function that needs to be taught there. But equally, I think that the, you know, I don't want to admonish synchronous communication, because I also see in our, you know, in some of the kind of driving forces of that drive towards asynchronous communication has led to things like everybody's calendars are now extremely booked with meetings, because there's this kind of discomfort around just picking up a call or having a huddle. And I think things are changing. Like, I think technology is now trying to adapt a little bit more to how do we introduce more synchronous comms and more synchronous decision-making. But I definitely see that as being a point of contention. Like, the expectation to, why aren't all documents kind of clear, written, easy to access? Why aren't decisions written down and accessible to everybody? Obviously, drives toward transparency is a big part of this as well. And this is the kind of thing that for a lot of older generations, and naturally that means a lot more leaders, because obviously that's people with a larger amount of experience, that is not coming naturally. That's a kind of a new mindset to get into, to be doing this, and it is an expectation. So it's definitely I think an interesting dynamic.
Absolutely. And it's been really interesting actually during the pandemic. I think everyone got very used to having a lot of meetings, and then we certainly found that as soon as people were able to go back into the offices, or some people were, actually the amount of meetings that we had blew up enormously, because everyone had said, oh well, now we need to be talking to everybody face to face all of the time, even if they're still working from home. And I remember colleagues and I looking at and being like, we've got back-to-back meetings all day every day, when are we actually going to get the rest of our work done? So it's finding that balance. Definitely.
I think also, like, remote working is extremely new as a phenomenon. Like, it's only really been actively in practice for what? I guess, like, probably kind of 2 years by force and 2 years by desire. And 2 years in the grand scheme of work is nothing. Like, it took us, I think, even like 100 years to get the printing press to be publicly adopted. So the idea that remote working is like kind of done or fixed, or we're at this kind of place where it all should be working really effectively, I think is a kind of unreasonable expectation. And it is going to take us, I think, probably another decade, really, before we really start getting into the groove of understanding how we can work together in this way. And by that point, there'll be a whole new disruption that we're ready to face.
So how crucial is it that actually people within the workforce recognize that we have different ages and there's that generational diversity? Because as you said, and even when I was thinking about it, actually 4 generations is something in the workforce that has snuck up on us, I think, rather than being anything that was a deliberate strategy by most firms. So how do we make sure that we're, as business people, understanding that we've got those differences of opinion, and how do we work towards that?
I wrote a book last year, which is all about the idea of people operations as a product, and this idea that your employees are customers, essentially, of this employee experience that you're creating for them, which is all in service of a fiscal product that is obviously your value to shareholders or investors or private equity or whoever it is, right? But your employee experience product is a really important product that serves that fiscal product, and your employees are essentially subscribing to that product every single month. Now, you have a responsibility as a people team or as a leader to deeply understand, like, which strategy, who do I want to be in the market, basically? If your employer is, one in a marketplace, which more than ever before, I think employers really are. I think about my parents' generation, and my dad is convinced that you just don't have a choice. Your job is just your job, and you do your job from the day that you can work until the day you don't work anymore. Whereas, of course, that's not a reality that I think a lot of us engage with anymore. Our job is very much a choice. And we are actively participating in this market of employers and, which is the right place for me? Where am I going to grow? Who's offering me the benefits and perks and learning and all these other things that I'm interested in? And I think employers need to be very cognizant about, well, who am I actually trying to engage? What is my ideal customer profile? And I don't mean discriminating against people based on their demographics. Absolutely not. Because I think you should be boiling it down to things like, are we looking for people who are maybe a riskier investment? So, maybe I'm focusing more on people that are new entrants into their career or career shifters or people that are willing to learn on the job. And that can be generationally agnostic. Or whether you're somebody that, really needs to drill in deep on highly experienced I-shape professionals and be a law firm or something like that. I think it's really important that you have a very clear understanding of who it is you're trying to attract in the market. What is their profile? What does that mean for you financially and commercially? And then build a strategy that works around that. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to try and talk to everybody, whether it be age, demographics, or otherwise. But it does make a lot of sense to try and talk to everybody that is an appropriate ideal customer profile for you. Now, again, I really want to stress this. It's not about discriminating and saying everybody in my company needs to be a Gen X or whatever it is, but it is about, we do need everyone in our company to be able to communicate asynchronously. That is a strategic imperative. So if I know that some of our team won't be able to do that because of their background and their history and their education and the experience they've had at work, then what am I doing as a worker, as an employer, to raise that level of understanding and level of awareness and level of experience so that everyone can participate in the culture that we've created in this marketplace?
And what are some of the ways that you've seen of upskilling those people who might not necessarily have got that background or had that education or used them before? Have you seen things that have worked well?
So I am a big advocate for this idea of achieving through others. I really love peer accountability. I think there are a lot of amazing tools, and I'm not going to go into these, but there are a lot of amazing tools that allow for self-driven learning and people to be able to create learning experiences online for individuals and all those kinds of things. I am still maybe a traditionalist who believes that the best way to learn is from seeing other people do an exceptional good job of the thing that you're trying to advocate for in your company. So for me, that is creating more platforms where people are able to be lifted and held to account and shown as doing the work that you really expect. So one of the things we do at Talentful, and actually Amazon is very famous for this, is a thing called the Weekly Business Review, or WBR. Now, I the kind of culture that we built at Whereby and the culture that we are building at Talentful is one that means that everyone in our team needs to be very commercial. So commercial awareness is something that's very important. Now, again, this is actually a skill that I think not everybody has learned generationally. A lot of, you know, especially if you have been working in business for a very long time, you naturally have probably a little bit more commercial awareness just because of osmosis, essentially. And if you are a younger entrant into the workforce, you may not ever have done a course where you've learned about what is EBITDA and why do we care about margins and all of these other bits and pieces. So we've created this space in the WBR where all of our key company metrics are shared, and then every week is a different chairperson from within the team. So the people team don't manage it, the ops team don't manage it, the C-suite don't manage it, an individual from the company will manage it. And it's about building a platform where we see really great members of the team, regardless of their level of experience, be able to adapt to what we expect of them there and say like, ah, that's what good commercial awareness looks like. So we're able to kind of lift up others through that visual learning, kind of, I guess, like community learning maybe is a better way to describe it. But I personally still believe that is the most effective way to really teach people what you expect to make your company successful.
Absolutely. And it really builds on the transparency piece that you mentioned earlier as well, around actually if people are understanding what they need to do, what good looks like, and then they have a pathway to be able to show that as well. I can see why that's a winning formula.
Yeah, totally. I mean, transparency is, I think the last couple of years, especially, you know, we have to remember the economic situation that a lot of these more junior entrants to the workforce have come in with, has been one of, honestly, like economic chaos for the last couple of years. They have essentially come into a workforce which has been highly volatile. There have been layoffs over the last couple of years. Prior to that, it was obviously the pandemic. And this is a circumstance in which I think, particularly when coupled with this asynchronous communication and like kind of structured decision-making and clear communications, people have a higher level of expectation of transparency around why decisions are being made, because they understand that it does ultimately affect them, affect their career, and they want to be more informed about which company they choose in the marketplace. Just like consumers have most recently a very stronger drive towards transparency about the supply chains, etc. And I think that is, again, very deeply connected to this kind of like the political and kind of social conditions that have happened around the last couple of years of employment. Whereas I think, again, if you ask my parents, and I don't want to be so focused on them, but even like, you know, folks of their generation, I think that they would have a much more, again, media probably plays a part of this, very trusting relationship with authority. You know, if your work tells you that something is happening and this is why a decision's been made, they're quite comfortable to accept that decision in a very different headspace and, you know, not any less worthy of virtue than somebody who grew up in a much more skeptical media environment and political environment where there has been a lot more chaos. They really do want to understand, oh, well, this is affecting me ultimately, so I want to understand the thought process here, which is a really interesting dynamic to work with.
Absolutely. No, and that takes me back to, I have a colleague who actually started his career in the US just before the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And he says that even now, many years later, actually those experiences still shape how he kind of comes to work and shows up and approaches things, because he said he saw some things that were really done well, and he saw other things that he said just, it was cruel. And, you know, the people had their livelihood stripped away from them immediately, and then so did everybody else who they worked with. So, and he said, actually, that's something that shaped him forever. But actually, if you joined the workforce a couple of years after that, you wouldn't have had those experiences. So I'm sure the pandemic is a similar one, because I'm always amazed when we hire recent graduates in, you know, the last couple of years, and actually they spent all of their university education or all of their latest school years working either from their parents' house or shut in some university halls. And so they're very used to working remotely and learning remotely in a way that even I and many of the colleagues, even a few years out from that, just have absolutely no comprehension of how you could do that entirely remotely. And yet it's now so, so normal to all of them. One of the things we often find as a bit of a challenge between people who have done a lot of remote study and are now coming into the workforce is that balance between saying we want to give those people flexibility, but we also want to give people the best onboarding and the best training experience that we can. So how do you typically balance that, and what do you see works well there?
I think, again, this kind of goes back to the point of like remote work is not some kind of final fixed product right now where we're like, we should have it all worked out. Like again, you have to create something that works for the company and who you want to be in the market. I know a lot of businesses that actually after the course of the last couple of years have realized actually all of our onboarding should not be remote. We would like people to be in person. We will fly people somewhere. We will meet people somewhere. And if that's the decision that strategically makes the most sense for you, I think that's a very, very important thing to do. I would be wary of looking at another company and what they're doing and saying, we should just rip that off. I think that's a really worrying thing. Because ultimately what you might end up with is something that works extremely well for another company, and then actually when applied to your workforce or your team and who you've hired and what experience they have, you find it is deeply ineffective. But I think one of the things about remote work is that it is very much driven around self-guidance and self, I guess, motivation. You haven't got somebody there in a room, for example. I think about my onboarding a box. Like I was in a room with somebody telling me the history of the company. It was not really possible for me to kind of block my ears and not participate in that conversation. Whereas now we have a situation where someone can just like, you know, 1.75x a video and just zip through it, tick a box on, you know, your learning platform, and they've done the learning. So it's much more about demonstrating the outcome than it is about ticking the inputs. And I think this is just kind of a general lesson for HR, is over the last couple of years, it's been very kind of, it's been a rude awakening, I think, for a lot of people in people operations, that inputs just plainly aren't enough to make work really work. You need to be focused on what the outputs are. So where is the demonstration that somebody's understood this? Where is the demonstration that somebody's able to implement this practice that we've taught them? And much less around like, we delivered this much training, and rather we saw this much outcome. And if you're focused on that and what is the outcomes you're trying to drive, and then actually designing something that you think is best place to make that happen, you're in a much better place than if you were to just take an onboarding that you saw work at another company.
Absolutely. And we've certainly found that it really depends on, as you said, on the person, because there are some people who go, yeah, I loved working from home or studying from home and I get the most out of it, and actually coming into the office is not the better option for me. I'm able to shut myself away at home and just get on with things. And then other people who go, no, actually, I miss that face-to-face relationship building, and that's the piece that's important to me. So I think it's, yeah, so on the money to say, actually, it depends on the people you have.
Absolutely. And like, again, this is part of this demographic thing I'm talking about. Like, if you are a company that is committed, so Whereby, I think, is a very, very strong position on the market in this way, in that we were fully distributed and remote before the pandemic. So we already had a kind of the remote infrastructure set up when the pandemic hit. Now, Whereby is fully distributed, totally global, hours agnostic. So you can work whatever hours work for you. So we have a very strong position in terms of who we want to be in the market, which means that our ideal kind of employee profile is never going to be somebody who requires a large amount of social interaction at work, because it just fundamentally would not work well with that culture. People are relatively isolated for hours at a time, autonomously making decisions, trawling through old documentation about kind of why a decision was previously made and educating themselves before implementing something. And that is plainly just, I mean, everyone likes the idea of like, I'd love to work hours agnostic. I can just work whatever hours work for me. But then the practicality of that double-edged sword hits you and you're like, am I actually the kind of person that would like to spend 5 hours alone in my house reading through old documentation in order to make decisions? Maybe not. And that is fine. But then equally, you have employers like, you know, Talentful, which is where I am now, which we do have quite a vibrant co-working type relationship, where our team has a very strong response to flexibility. They really want the flexibility. Again, we have like a fairly kind of youthful in terms of generational age workforce. And they really love the flexibility, but they do also want the social element. So we've had to build something that bakes socialization into that, which means that we do have to have geographic pay bands, for example, because we are paying people to be close to certain regional areas. And we do have to have some kind of service that provides co-working memberships to people. So we do partner with DeskPass, which is just a very different reality than Whereby, but technically both companies are remote.
How have you found kind of the transition between those for you? So obviously you will have got used to one way of working and now be bringing in a different one. So how have you found that shift?
I am the kind of person who's much more productive in my house than I am in an office. I am just the worst faffer in the world when I go into an office. I talk to everybody. I like get up and make coffee. I pat the dogs. It's terrible, but also fun. Like that, I enjoy being in the office environment. I don't know how I got any work done back in 2018. I find the office has a very distinct place for me. When I do go in and meet other people and we do co-working, I make that as much as possible, like try to remove meetings from my calendar and really make it about just spending time with people and getting to know them and having conversations. When I'm home, I'm much more productive. I don't really find the adaptation personally that difficult. It's just been a realization for myself of like what actually works for me and how do I make it work for the company as well. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that we did at Talentful in February was we launched DeskPass. So we did have hub locations with different little offices in various hubs. We closed those hubs down and we just had an open, completely flexible co-working membership that we've now split out. And this is again in response to like a large push for more flexibility. People were really unhappy about the idea of having to come into the office a couple of days a week if they had to. So introducing that's been, again, going back to this idea of like giving people opportunities to see the work and then understand what was expected of them. It's been a very enlightening experience because implementing this has kind of forced people to realize, oh, there's no such thing as a good option for everybody. Like this office doesn't work for me, but it works for my best friend. And this office works for five of us, but two people don't like commuting there. And there's just been this really good kind of organic realization that, organizing the logistics behind getting people face-to-face is actually extremely challenging. And it is not something that we as employees should be like, you know, expecting our company to get perfect because they absolutely can't. And I think that's actually been a really like nice maturing opportunity for a lot of our team who have realized, well, I can take accountability if I really care about this. And if I don't really care about this and I'm happy to go with the flow, then I will step back and allow one of my peers take that responsibility. And I think it's really been very, very beneficial for us to kind of give that accountability and ownership to the team while also giving them options and flexibility.
Absolutely. And have you found that there tend to be generational or even kind of family life or gendered responses to those? Because we got a lot of feedback during the pandemic when there were a lot of people working from home while homeschooling their kids in the UK, yeah, when lots of the schools were closed. And actually we had parents of both genders say, when they were going back, actually, I really want to be able to now pick my kids up after school now that things have opened again. And I, you know, I relish the time that I can spend with them. And why was I wasting 2 hours of everyday commuting when I now am immediately with my family? Just interested if you saw some of that was quite age or family setup dependent.
Yeah, I think, you know, you and I have already had like a brief conversation about how I feel about the age gap, and that I really do believe it's just reflective of a gender gap. Like if you actually really look at it, and to put even more of a fine point on it, it's also about marginalized people. Like the majority of people of older generation that are still in the workforce are not women, and they're definitely not women of color, very much more likely to be a white male, who absolutely have massive kind of wealth and experience to bring to the workforce. The reality is, for the last couple of years, I think before the pandemic, definitely, the kind of lack of flexibility that workplaces offered really did mean that women were more frequently stepping out of the workforce. So what we are left with is a generation of people that are kind of basically reflective of the entire generation, but actually only really reflective of a very specific group, which is men. So I do think that hopefully one of the things that we have been seeing lately with the kind of push towards more flexibility, push towards more hours flexibility, not just location flexibility, has been that we are seeing more women participate in the workforce at older ages than they have in the past. And, you know, obviously still the kind of proof is in the pudding a little bit here. We'll see what happens the next couple of years. But workplaces, I think, in just implementing flexible locations or flexible hours, by default, have made it a lot more friendly for women, particularly after having children, as you mentioned, to remain in the workforce with their caring responsibilities.
Absolutely. No, I spoke to a guy who runs his own business and also does a lot of talks and things on retirement and supporting workers as they get older. And one of the really interesting kind of theories that he had was actually that more companies should be allowing people flexible working when they're coming up to retirement. So rather than having the cliff edge of you hit retirement age and off you go immediately, that actually you should be encouraging people to go part-time. And I thought part of that was very interesting because it was introducing part-time working to men who probably traditionally hadn't had that throughout their careers, whereas women are much more likely to have done part-time as part of kind of raising their families and those sorts of things. So hopefully that flexibility also leads to it being more normalized for men to be part-time as well as women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think flexibility is like, it's really, it's a win-win for everybody. Let's be clear. Like, I think actually again, going back to this inputs versus outputs thing, like it's really starting to drive us towards like work is really about the output, like the work that you are doing and the kind of success that you're driving for your company. And that can be done in all different kinds of ways. And I think that's largely actually a really welcome change. It's much easier to assess performance when it's based on outputs. It's much easier to allow people the flexibility to work in a way that really works for them and like to create a more diverse and inclusive culture. Of course, if you're focused on outputs rather than inputs, of course, there are double-edged swords to flexibility, and I think this is one of the things that we're kind of talking about in relation to this generation gap is we flexibility, particularly around like communications at work, is what I think causes these challenges. Our older workforce is much more used to rigid start stop times, much more used to kind of rigid ways of communication, much more used to honestly inputs rather than outputs. I think like as much as we understand that idea cognitively, I do think it actually is still a more difficult thing to understand when you grew up with the idea that you arrive at work at 9, you leave work at 6, you like during that time you have a half hour for break for lunch and you sit at your desk and you eat your lunch. That's just not what work really looks like anymore. And as much as we all kind of, I think, enthusiastically embrace flexible working, we have to remember that we're talking about, for some people, 40, 50 years of work experience that has been very specific. And now we're saying in the course of 2 years, completely change your entire worldview. And that is, I think, actually kind of an unfair thing to do. It just, even if it's in the best interest of everybody, we have to accept that it actually does take a lot of undoing in order to get to a new place.
I wanted to ask you about some of the ways that younger people can help older workers through this transition. So I know sometimes it's talked about as reverse mentoring with more junior people teaching more senior people. And don't know if that's words that you would use to describe it, but interested to see some ways that you've seen that work well.
Again, like I talk a lot about like learning through osmosis or learning through community or accountability rather than creating some kind of program that's very structured and tick box. I still think that has the space for that kind of learning in the workplace. I just much more prefer to talk about the first type. But one of the ways I think that younger generations do a really fantastic job of this kind of like learning through osmosis is actually their propensity to share knowledge, which is something that I find personally very inspiring. And also I know that a lot of the members of our team that are more senior just aren't as effective at or efficient at. People that grew up with social media as standard communication are used to the idea of, oh, I read this article, other people would like it, or here's something that I think is interesting that other people might want to learn more about, or here's my opinion about something and I'm going to put it out there in the world. You know, the older generation doesn't have that built into them. The idea of publicly declaring that something you found was interesting so other people would find it interesting, it's not a natural move, I think, for some of the older generation, but younger generation are fantastic at it. So good. So I really love to encourage those members of our team that are very, very natural at doing this to enjoy that platform, take that platform, encourage other people to do it, and encourage more of a kind of social online environment at work as it relates to sharing things that they found really interesting and informative. Because often, even if somebody is, for example, like a junior recruiter in our team, they may have an article very, very interesting that they read about the economy that our CFO may be interested in picking up and reading, right? So it's not as if people are sharing stuff that isn't universally interesting. And I think that that's one of the things that we really do try and encourage at Talentful is share socially things that you're interested in reading, that you found enlightening in some way, that you think others may be interested in, and try to create that kind of like more vibrant sharing environment.
Amazing. No, I think that's fantastic to think about. It would be very unlikely even 10 years ago if you'd said, well, actually, you know, I read something fascinating over the weekend and I'm going to email it to everybody in my team. I think the team might be a bit like, okay, but posting a blog on a Teams chat or a Slack message doesn't seem anywhere near as weird.
I don't know what it's like for you, but when I kind of grew up professionally, when I was very kind of more junior in my career, the way that you digested that kind of shared information was like a structured corporate newsletter. Do you remember these? Like the HR team would send out, and maybe I'm sure a lot of people teams still do send out newsletters, so like absolutely no discredit to them. I think they're really useful. But that was like the way that you learned something, was that the people team would agree with maybe the leadership team, like, these are the three things that we want our company to read this month. We'll send it out in an email. And now the idea that we have this kind of vibrant upwards communication of stuff that people find interesting, and, you know, our team will post policies that other companies have published and said, like, I really like that this company did this, as a kind of feedback on the ways of working as well, which I find really, really nice. It's just a completely different way of engaging with content and the world than even, you know, 15 years ago.
Can you talk a little bit more about how other advancements in HR technology can help with this? So ensuring fair practices, promoting diversity, and as you've said, sharing information that otherwise might not be shared.
Yeah, I mean, we have so many tools now that are literally designed to help us communicate better remotely. I think there's a couple of things. Again, like, I don't think that this world is done. I think there's still a lot of work that's going in. Even just looking at like the different video conferencing providers that have come out in the last couple of years, the amount of progress and change, and now we have AI written summaries and notes and all these other things happening all the time, right? You know, try to find a technology stack that really works for your team, but acknowledge that this is going to be a progressive, like, adaptation to remote working. Try to build, I've got this little like 9-box grid type thing, which is about frequency and permanency of communication. Basically, your team will be more psychologically safe if you have something that ticks each of the boxes of these 9 boxes. So high frequency versus low frequency communication. So for example, Slack or Teams would be extremely high frequency. It's kind of like constant communication, just a flow of consciousness. And then low frequency would be something like a newsletter or an all hands presentation, something like that. And then permanency is how like resistant to time that communication is. So again, Slack and Teams, very low permanency. You know, you have to kind of like index through bunches of old notes. It's in DMs, it's in channels, you have to figure out where it is. It's not meant to be a permanent archive, although it obviously can be. And then high permanency would be something like, you know, an employee shared drive that gets shared during onboarding with all of the archived all hands meetings where they're clearly historically documented with notes, blah, blah, blah. And if you have something that kind of ticks all of these 9 boxes, so high frequency, high permanency, low frequency, low, et cetera, et cetera, what you'll end up with is a group of employees that are able to make more reasoned decisions about how they want to communicate online. So if you are a company that has just said, like, we've just implemented Zoom and Slack or Teams, and then that's it, we're all done, you have to acknowledge that the reality of the situation is actually you might be missing some very important steps here for people to, you know, search archival information or have a quick one-off conversation without having to book a meeting. So I'd say, like, start with booking something in every one of those boxes. And then once you've got that stack, accept that it's a changing process and get feedback and kind of work with your provider to make sure it's implemented very effectively. But you are working within the great arms of technology, right? So you you can't just build your own tool. If you did, I'm sure you should be doing that probably instead of whatever it is your company's doing.
Absolutely. No, and I think that's absolutely fascinating. I hadn't heard of that 9-box grid before, because I can completely see how if you only had one or you only had the other, or some of the extremes, but not all of the full suite, actually, you're either not telling your employees enough or too formally, or you're only telling them in the moment, and what a waste of time of having to continually tell everything in the immediate time that they need to know it. So yeah, that's absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely. You're also very specifically driving their behavior, which I think is an interesting thing about technology in the workplace, is whatever you implement changes the behavior of your team. So if you implement something that only allows them to book meetings, basically, and not have like a chat functionality, then you are naturally going to create a workforce which does not have as much organic conversation. What does that mean for your company? You need to really, you know, thinking about like not just the way that you communicate with your team, but also the way that they are going to communicate together is going to be obstructed by what you implement. So don't just try to like, oh, we need a chat functionality, so I'm just going to implement Teams because that's what another company's doing. Really think about like, you know, how is our team currently communicating? Which gap is this filling? How is this tool effectively going to fill that gap? Is information archived? Is it transcriptable? Blah, 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 blah. It's really, really helpful.
Absolutely. And I know we're coming up towards the end of our time today. So thanking you very much for coming and joining me today. Really, really appreciated talking to you. And to everyone listening, I hope you found it as insightful as I did. Please remember to browse through our other episodes if you enjoyed this one, and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. So a huge thank you again, Jessica, for joining us today.